Hello everyone, this is Nick Deolius. Welcome to another episode of the Far Middle Podcast, episode number 23. And looking at who was the greatest athlete or the favorite athlete in sports to wear number 23, I think there can only be one for this episode. That is, of course, Michael Jordan. I think he's the greatest and the most accomplished athlete in the history of sports, not just basketball. I know that's a bold statement, but when you consider what Michael Jordan brought to the table over his accomplished career, it's actually hard to argue with that bold statement. And what's really interesting with Jordan, sure, there's his athleticism, which was second to none when it comes to people or individuals to step on a basketball court. There's all those titles and rings. There's this aspect with Jordan that I found really interesting and impressive, which is how he was able to be what I consider to be the first megastar to brand his name and his image. He turned his product, his brand into something that went way beyond basketball. Basketball was almost a sideshow toward the end of it. So he's very successful commercially. All that stuff, extremely impressive. But it's not the singular item that is most impressive to me when it comes to Michael Jordan, why I consider him to be the greatest athlete of all time. Because when it comes to the most impressive attribute, it's his heart. He had the most dedicated drive that I think anyone's ever seen in sports. He comes to the Bulls back in the day out of North Carolina, and he, for years, is the only legitimate threat on that team. And that went on, as I said, year after year. He toiled on, he got double or triple teamed every game, and he got beat on, frankly, after every game, physically beat on. If you think about the great teams he had to go through in his era to win championships, it's almost mind-boggling. And it went through just entire periods of time and epics where great teams, great dynasties came and went, but he was there to basically be challenged by them and then overcome them time and time again. So first, of course, there was the Boston Celtics, and they had Larry Bird and company. And the thing about the Celtics from that era, the early, mid, late 80s era, they were underrated nasty. They were a tough team. And they knew how to take their toll on Jordan over the course of a game or a playoff series. So there were series there, I remember, before Jordan and the Bulls figured out the Celtics, where Jordan would score 50-some points in a playoff game, but you know the Bulls would end up losing the game and the Celtics would end up winning the series. But ultimately, of course, he eventually vanquished the Celtics and the Bulls moved on. And then when they moved on, what was waiting for him? There were the Pistons. And the Detroit Pistons were the meanest, most physical, dirtiest team probably in NBA history. I can't, certainly in recent NBA history over the past 50 years, the Detroit Pistons had to have been the nastiest team of them all. I guess you don't get the nickname the Bad Boys for nothing. So they had the infamous Jordan rules, which were pretty simple, brutally simple. When Jordan touched a ball, you put him on the ground. I don't know, frankly, how he survived, let alone how he overcame and ended up beating the Pistons when he was leading the Bulls. I just go back and think about Dennis Rodman, before he jumped ship, and Bill Laimbeer, how they had their orders before each game from Chuck Daly, the coach of Detroit. So officially, right, the orders and the game plan was to wear Jordan out, but the reality of it was that the game plan was to beat him or hurt him, worse yet. Didn't matter. No one player or system ever stopped Michael Jordan. That's just part of his greatness. And then after he got past the Celtics and he overcame the Detroit Pistons, he had overcome the Lakers and Magic Johnson and that sort of cast of talent, an array of talent, to win titles. So think about that. After you go through all these beatings that are administered by the Celtics or the Pistons, you still had to beat teams like the Lakers to get the championship. And he did that with the Bulls. And don't forget, people often forget this too, but there were two other teams that had what I'd call their own version of the Jordan rules that were rivaling and coming close to what the Detroit Pistons had to offer with respect to nastiness. And those, of course, were the New York Knicks and the Indiana Pacers. So throughout his career, Jordan took, I think, more cumulative punishment than most professional boxers take over the course of their careers. And that boy, isn't that saying something? For my money, he's the greatest athlete of all time. Yeah, in part because of the titles and the talent and the brand, but most importantly, because of his determination and his toughness. You can't teach heart. Everybody knows that. But if you want to see heart in action, watch those playoffs with Michael Jordan. You'll learn a lot. Now, on this special number, episode 23 of the Far Middle, we're going to stick to the themes of connections of discrete yet related dots, but we're going to dedicate our time on this episode to a handful. We're going to have six quick hitters in succession of common sense recommendations that if they were adopted, they would have an immediate and I think a material improvement on the state of this great nation economically, culturally, from a society perspective, all of the above, all three of those. So when we've been talking about things that are maybe wrong with the world on prior episodes of The Far Middle, and God knows there is plenty to keep talking about on that front, let's spend this episode talking about six simple, direct things that we could do to remedy quite a bit of the wrong that's out there. And I want to thank a number of the constant listeners out there for this suggestion. I got some feedback over the past couple of weeks listening to the episode saying, these are awesome, these are great. We're tuning in each week to hear what's current on your mind. How about dedicating an episode to what you would consider to be common sense approaches that would quickly and easily remedy a lot of the ills that are out there culturally, economically, and societally? So I want to thank the constant listeners for that idea. So let's go. The first recommendation is pretty basic. I'm going to start with the government, particularly the federal government. The idea is simple. The federal government would be required to adopt a balanced budget annually. The government can't outspend what it takes in. It's simple. It's basic. It's commonsensical when you consider we all have to do this very thing in our personal lives and with the businesses that we work at or that we own or that we manage. And it's also necessary now that our national debt is approaching $30 trillion. The national debt on the federal side sits at over $250,000 per taxpayer. And the debt cannot keep going up. We're now sitting at a federal debt load that is over 125% of gross domestic product, or GDP. We haven't seen those levels since World War II. A balanced budget requirement will at least arrest the debt growth. It may not make the debt go down, but at least it will stop it from growing. And there is much to manage to reduce spend if that's how we want to balance the federal budget. The federal government spends almost $7 trillion annually. Its deficit sits at almost $3 trillion annually, which gets added to the massive debt load every year. Those are huge numbers. And by the way, this rule, I think, should be applied using the real math of spending, not the misleading math that excludes entitlement spend and the like. You add in deficit spending to Social Security, you add in deficit spending to Medicare, and so on. Spend is spend, debt is debt. Balance the real federal budget to avoid defaulting on the real federal government debt. Let's operate in the real world for a change when it comes to the governance of government. Now, this common sense approach should also, I think, be adopted by state and local governments as well. There's much work that needs to be done on those two fronts. State debt is over $1 trillion. It's over $1.2 trillion. And local government debt is an astounding $2+ trillion. When you add together federal, state, and local government spending, it comes in at over $10 trillion annually. Do you feel like you are getting $10+ trillion in value as a citizen and a taxpayer? I'm guessing that you don't. And yes, I mean, there is no doubt requiring a balanced government budget, it's going to force challenging decisions and choices. So debates are going to rage about what to cut, how much, the consequences of spending reductions, and so on. There's going to be debates about what to tax, how much to tax, and so on when it comes to the tax side and the revenue side of the equation. And guess what? All of that debate and all of that discourse are really good things. What is bad is pretending that we don't need to make these choices and to keep outspending. We're at the point of a major crisis, and insolvency is upon us before we know it. I would personally love to see in a constitutional amendment something that requires this type of fiscal sanity to be preserved as politicians come and go and issues or challenges come and go, and the bureaucratic state continually attempts to feed and consume more value. So I think something like a constitutional amendment for this recommendation would codify, solidify, make it permanent, where it wouldn't be subject to the whims of politicians or challenges or the bureaucratic state with respect to what they want to achieve in the short term. Now, recommendation number two, let's scale back the Federal Reserve's mission creep and insists that it begins to stop quantitative easing and begin a rate rise to normal interest rates or to normalize interest rates. This is a massively huge problem. We've talked about this in the past. That's creating systemic risk in our economy and the capital markets and frankly in society. But because it's a faceless, misunderstood bureaucracy, most people are unaware of what the Fed is doing and how it affects them. But it's doing quite a bit and it's affecting them quite a lot. Part of this recommendation realizes that the Fed is spread way too far and wide and way too thin. So it's dabbling in massive ways as measured by trillions of dollars into areas it does not have competency in. And I'll just give you a couple examples. The first one is climate change, or what's the phraseology, tackling climate change. I think that's a great example of how the Fed's mission creep has gotten into areas it knows little about. I mean, remember, these are economists. They're trained in academia, typically. They're working in government. They don't know about climate science, and they can't figure out how to control inflation and unemployment. They certainly can't figure out how to control the weather. So let's have the Fed stop trying to control the winter temperatures 50 years from now by throwing around its multi-trillion dollar balance sheet. That's destroying value, and it's making things a lot worse. Another example beyond climate change or tackling climate change is how the Fed is getting into these other arenas, things in as far-ranging as race relations, immigration, vaccines and COVID, and so on. Those things are not their job. They have no expertise in those arenas. And when the Fed dives into them like a bull in a china shop, it stands to make matters worse, much worse, and frankly do real damage to the very things that they're trying to improve. And it also puts at risk the Fed's supposed or theoretical independence from politics and from politicians. The more the Fed gets into policy issues beyond the monetary, the more the political and subject to political winds the Fed is going to become. Now, the second part of this recommendation when it comes to the Fed that I mentioned was stopping this massive quantitative easing, all the bond buying, and then raising interest rates to moderate to normal levels. Those things are necessary to stop just a massive distortion of capital markets and to get the economy and society off of their addiction to free money. We've become addicted to free money provided by the Fed, which has become the pusher. This Fed free money extravaganza that's been going on really since 2009, it's disrupting the equilibrium everywhere and with everything. I'll give you a few examples of this. The most obvious one is housing, because the Fed creates asset bubbles in housing due to borrowed money being effectively free. That increases the cost of the homes and makes affordability ironically lower. That's just the exact opposite aim that the Fed had. That's why economic mobility has come to a halt per our discussion on, I think, the prior episode of the Far Middle, episode 22, last week. And near zero interest rates, it pummels savings account yields and bond yields, which is effectively a tax on savers, which then drives all investors to plow into more risky and more speculative investments, whether they're stocks or art or pricey real estate, so on. The Fed creates a massive asset bubble. And if a crisis hits or the Fed loses control or credibility, guess what? Look out below for everyone. And the Fed is also creating winners and losers in the capital markets, big winners and big losers. Hedge funds in the aggregate, I don't know if you guys have been following this, in the aggregate, they haven't beat the S&P for years. And a big reason why is because near zero interest rates and free money, it allows sick and mismanaged companies to go on perpetually and doesn't allow for survival of the fittest to take root in the market. That kills the long short and the arbitrage hedge funds rely on to then do their thing and help balance equilibrium of capital flows in the market. So the hedge fund industry has really been penalized in large part because of Fed policy. Meanwhile, another big area of the capital markets, private equity, has been rewarded by Fed policy because it allows them to continue to acquire and to be perpetually financed by limitless and free debt. So I'm not, you know, here to advocate for hedge funds or to rail against private equity firms. I'm neither anti-private equity or pro-hedge fund, but I do know that picking winners and losers between these different types and pools of the capital markets, that's distorting trillions of dollars in capital flows, and it's going to impact everyone at some point. So the Fed, while it hammers mom and pops with no interest income, it's also, guess what, rewarding the super wealthy. I don't know if you realize this or not, but there are multimillionaires to billionaires. So these are some of the most wealthy individuals that you're going to find in this nation that are out there who borrow millions of dollars under a 2-3% interest rate loan. And then they use it to go do things like buy huge homes or invest in assets that then appreciate above the borrowing costs. So they're basically using free money instituted and provided by the Fed to go borrow to get proceeds to then plow into these types of assets that are creating bubble pricing mechanisms with them because of the same Fed policy and take advantage of that arbitrage. They're borrowing money at 2-3% and they're putting them into assets that are appreciating much higher than that because of the pricing bubbles that the Fed is creating. basically the wealthy are getting a free ride from the Fed and the little guy is paying for it. So again, just to be clear, I am pro-wealth. I think the United States needs more billionaires, not less. But there is a right way and a wrong way to achieve that. Go create value. Go invent something. Go do something legitimate. You shouldn't get there becoming a billionaire, let's say, by government stacking things in your favor. And what's ironic about this is we have our Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, who has the nerve to say that she sets policy for Main Street and not Wall Street. Really? Recommendation number three is a big one. Stop, drop, kill all regulations, laws, treaties, and accords that are aimed at tackling climate change and saving the planet. There are a few fundamental reasons for this recommendation. First, these moves do not save the planet, and in fact, they're going to make the environment worse. Wind and solar are prime examples of this. Just about every law, regulation, treaty is going to favor wind and solar forms of power generation. They have a larger life cycle carbon footprint than natural gas power generation, and it's not even close. There is not only no zero carbon future awaiting us, but hugging wind and solar brings a higher carbon future. So if you care about CO2 and you're worried about future temperatures, then most of the climate regulations and laws, they're going to make matters worse with respect to those metrics. Second, the move to tackle climate change is a massive regressive tax on the working poor and the middle class. It reduces economic productivity, and it subsidizes the rent-seeking multi-billion dollar corporation that's setting and gaming the rules. This, in the end, when you net it all out, most of these climate change or tackling climate change initiatives, they are a net-net redistribution of wealth that we cannot afford nor desire. It's completely going in the wrong direction when it comes to the redistribution. Third, you move away from domestic natural gas and oil, and you run into the arms of things like wind and solar and batteries. Those items, those characteristics are a geopolitical and strategic blunder. It benefits China and Russia, and it harms the United States and the Western democracies. It's that simple. Now, I'm on Team USA. If you favor mandates for wind and solar, frankly, you're on Team CCP, as in Chinese Communist Party. The best example I can give you of this, if you don't believe it, is what's going on with Europe. The EU chose renewable and carbon mandates, and now guess who they answer to? They answer to a guy named Vlad Putin. Fourth, you drop climate religion from policy, it's going to help heal our budget deficit, it's going to increase the tax base, it's going to reduce unemployment, and it's going to reduce the national debt. Domestic energy grows GDP and family-sustaining jobs. Everybody knows that. So let me sort of translate this for you based on your chosen political language, whether you're red or blue. You can't build back better with wind and solar, and you can't make America great again without domestic natural gas. It's just that simple when it comes to the economics of both. And then the fifth and last reason for dropping all these regulations, laws, treaties, and accords when it comes to tackling climate change, almost 2 billion people on this planet do not currently have access to reliable electricity. And life for them is brutal, and it's short. The quickest way to get them that precious access to things like electricity and all the benefits that it provides, the quality of life, is giving the poor in the world access to natural gas. What will surely delay the time of their access to electricity and all the good things that comes from it is mandating things like wind and solar and banning things like natural gas. So we can get them there quicker by getting them access to natural gas and favoring natural gas development, or we can completely delay the time to when they get to a better place indefinitely by mandating things like wind and solar and outlawing or banning things like natural gas. Billions of poor depend on the right decisions to be made by nations like the United States. This is a moral imperative, not just an economic one. Yes, dropping the massive drag and distortion of the real world under the banner of climate or tackling climate change will actually allow us to be much more resilient and better prepared for whatever life and Mother Nature throw at us, whether it's cold or hot, short or long, big or small. Now, my fourth recommendation to put things on a better track economically and culturally is one that's so obvious that I'm shocked no one is clamoring for this. So maybe this is the far middle's contribution to how to get our country back on the right track. Any forgiveness of student college debt has to be paid for by the school's endowment and not by the taxpayer. This is a simple rule, and it follows the facts and reasons of the situation. Yes, many students and parents have been ripped off by colleges and higher education, no doubt about that. Tuition skyrockets while job prospects plummet. Little doubt about that. These people were sold a bill of goods that didn't exist, and restitution under classic contract common law should be made where it's appropriate. And contract law canons teach us that restitution should not be paid by the taxpayer who did nothing wrong and was not a willing party in the transaction, but instead, restitution should be paid by the wrongdoer in the transaction. So any student debt forgiveness must be paid for by the student's college or university endowment until there is either no more debt forgiveness or until there's no more endowment. Pretty simple. And it is a simple logic. Who are the victims and who are being had? The student? Yep. Parents? For sure. Taxpayers? Uh-huh. And who are the perps in this scheme? Governments and the universities. They colluded to create tuition bubbles and to dilute the educational value and to shrink the drivers of the real economy that would be offering the best paying jobs and careers. So who should pay restitution for this scam? The taxpayer? No way. The student or family that was tricked or misled? Nope. The perp should. Well, you can't have government pay because that is all of us. That goes back to the taxpayer. So it should be the colleges and universities who benefited from looks to be graft bordering on fraud. And these institutions, by the way, they have been grossly enriched by this scheme. Just consider some of these endowment levels. Harvard's got the biggest endowment of a college or university in the land. It's over $40 billion, $40 billion at Harvard. Columbia is $11 billion, NYU, $4 billion endowment. We talked about, I think, film studies degrees at both in the past on a Far Middle podcast, and what a disgrace that is with respect to students and grads coming out of film studies that don't have any hope for a decent job, and they've got massive amounts of tuition debt. Public schools, by the way, are just as bad as private schools. Texas, University of Texas system, $30 billion endowment. Michigan, University of Michigan, $12.5 billion endowment. And to have a billion-dollar endowment at a college or university today is very commonplace. There's dozens and dozens of schools and universities that have $1 billion or higher of an endowment. So restitution and debt forgiveness, it should come through these endowments and the perpetrators, simple and logical. Doing so would catalyze reform, and it would be not just optical reform, but true and tangible reform. So this wouldn't just be able to be avoided by wordsmithing. You'd actually have to legitimately reform. And tapping the endowments until the failed higher education model is fixed, or until the broken one that is unwilling to correct its course is held accountable, that's a good thing, not just a logical thing. Number five in our half dozen fixes to our society is to require that every public union contract, doesn't matter if it's for police, fire, teachers, maintenance workers, etc., has to encompass a specific set of performance criteria, performance metrics that need to be hit. Now, we've talked about public unions in the past. I'm not talking about private unions with this recommendation. I'm very supportive of private unions and their role that they play. So whether it's the building trades or other types of private unions, that's a whole different situation and animal altogether. I'm talking about public sector unions. Public sector unions inherently are conflicted with respect to the customer or the entity that they're serving, which is the taxpayer, the public. And that's because the politician who is elected is negotiating contracts with the public union, but then the public union is providing everything from political contributions to votes back to the politician. So when you look at that circle of politician, public union, and then taxpayer or customer, whether it's a student or a parent or a homeowner, you know who's going to lose in that conflict if you're not being careful with being able to deliver quality service. It's going to be the taxpayer or the homeowner or the student. And there's this inherent conflict where the politician is going to be motivated, incentivized to grant contracts that are very lax on performance expectations or very rich and very high with respect to pay and benefits to the public union, which will then exchange that for political contributions, votes, et cetera. So there's an inherent conflict with public unions that you don't find with private unions. The way to address that, I believe, is to set clear performance metrics that the profession would be held to. So what I'm thinking about are things like reading and math proficiency in our public schools for teachers in the teachers union. If the teachers can't deliver an agreed to service of being able to have students read and do math, then the taxpayer and parents should not be made to perform their side of the bargain of paying them under the contract. Now, think about this. What would happen if suddenly a municipality or a state decided to only pay half of the contractual rate to teachers that was set in a collective bargaining agreement? There would be outrage from teachers, and rightfully so, because that would be a breach of the agreement, of the accord that was in existence. But somehow, we lost symmetry in that contractual arrangement on the other side. Today, many of our largest, and particularly urban schools, and many others beyond the big cities, they don't post, they don't produce proficiency scores for students that are anywhere close to acceptable. We talked about this when it came to eighth graders, and particularly Black eighth graders in our big cities, on a prior episode of The Far Middle. When you look at reading proficiency, math proficiency, science proficiency, it's a disgrace as to what level of service, so to speak, these students and their parents and our next generation are being subjected to. Millions of kids are paying a lifetime price, and they're doing so in society as well as in the economy. So there's not a symmetry here. And I use the example, of course, of teachers when it comes to this example of a public union recommendation. But the same can apply to all other public sector professions. There is a social compact and an economic contract, and taxpayers agree to pay this in exchange for that, that being a service, this being wage rate, benefits, etc. The service should be clearly defined as to what passes muster and what does not. Right now, with too many public unions, their ability to deliver acceptable service is not really of importance. And changing that instantly boosts society. And it would also boost the respect that taxpayers have for their fellow citizens working in these professions and in these sectors. So let's go do that. The last and sixth recommendation for making a step change improvement in the country and society at large is going to deal with big tech, and particularly with social media. For too long, these tech social media titans have enjoyed having it both ways on an important but a nuanced issue. And that has stifled free speech and increased censorship. Cumulatively over time, that can take a toll on a nation like ours, where fundamental individual rights, of course, have played a really crucial and a legacy role. So what am I talking about here? It's something as simple as a definition or a name that can make a massive difference. Is Google, through YouTube or Facebook, are they platforms and conduits for information, or are they publishers? This little detail is becoming a critical factor that's going to impact the futures of the biggest tech giants in the world, as well as things like our free speech rights. So is a platform or a conduit, what some people will refer to as a public forum, a network provider or a social media engine or an engine, search engine algorithm, is not going to be subjected to onerous government oversight. If you're considered a platform or a conduit where people spread thoughts and opinions, you've also got this added advantage of not being legally responsible for the content on your sites. Now, the disadvantage of being a platform or conduit is that you have to keep the space open to everyone, whether you agree or disagree with their politics or their social views. So there's pros and cons of being a platform and conduit. But the Googles and YouTube and Facebook, they now face a bit of a self-inflicted legitimate risk because they want to have it both ways. You know, they want the lax regulation and shield from the legal liability of a platform or conduit. They'll take that attribute or those positive attributes. But they also want the ability to control what material and message is being placed on their spaces of a publisher. So they want the advantages of a publisher of being able to control content, but they also want the advantages of a conduit or platform by having lax regulation and no liability. So for years, Google was considered nothing more than a search engine, right? Facebook was nothing more than an app. Both during those periods of time were basically platforms and conduits, and that set them free under lax regulation to hunt down and suffocate traditional news providers such as print media and cable news. And it also allowed them to push favored political and social views while suppressing other views without having the fear of being charged with libel or slander or whatever the case might be. So common sense tells us today that the Googles, because of their ability to impact search, and the Facebooks, because what, more than half of the young people are getting their news from apps, and the Amazons, because of the ability to promote or not promote selected books, that they are increasingly looking more and more like news and content publishers. And that's going to subject these tech titans to the same standards as newspapers and news stations, along with the same types of liability. Now, what if we, this is where the recommendation comes in, what if we made these tech giants choose whether they are a platform or publisher? And if they do so, it would protect free speech, it would reduce censorship, and it would put social media entities on the same footing and have to deal with the same issues that the rest of their competitors in print media and in software need to contend with. Each choice, right, whether you go with publisher or whether you go with platform, each choice has its pros and cons, and each tech giant would be free to make its own choice. Let the tech entities make their own choice between those two. But right now, allowing social media behemoths to take only the advantages of both publishers and platforms and avoid all of the responsibilities that comes with either, that's unfair to its customers and to its competitors, and I fear it's affecting things like free speech and individual rights. So with social media playing now a truly, truly outsized role in the economy and in politics and in society, it's time to choose for them. Platform or publisher, choose thy weapon. Well, there you have it, the big six, half dozen straightforward common sense recommendations to reset this country back on the right track and to allow individuals to achieve and doers to create value. It's many of the things that we hold ourselves to in our everyday lives and are also themes I discuss in my upcoming book, Precipice, which again hits stores January 17th of next year. So please order your copies ahead of time. That would be awesome. Also, you can always follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. It's been a lot of fun engaging with some thoughts and tweets day to day on the Twitter platform. And then check out the website, nickdeolius.com. Over the past couple weeks, I put some new content out there. We've got an essay on Malta, a what if. If you're into what if scenarios in history or military history, I've got a World War II what if scenario for you to consider. What if Germany and the Axis powers had decided to go after Malta and focus more on the Mediterranean, forego the invasion of Russia, Operation Barbarossa? I think World War II could have come out quite differently and not in a good way. For the individual and for the rest of the world, but give that a read if you get a chance. And I've also got updates regularly being posted on our mentorship academy with young adults and focusing on those seniors in our urban and rural underserved communities in Western PA and getting them exposed to professional opportunities that don't require a college degree and that pay family-sustaining wages. It's been an awesome experience to date. It's still early on in a program, but we've been blogging after each event to just give you a very brief update and download on how that's going. So in the words of Michael Jordan for episode 23 of The Far Middle, if you saw that documentary, The Last Dance, which is awesome if you haven't, give it a look. Even if you're not a sports fan, you'll like it. I took it personal. I hope you take it personal too. Talk to you soon.